from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, conductor Laura Jackson. She's guest conducting the Sacramento Philharmonic this weekend. Also, violinist, singer David LaFlame. But first, when government and industry get together, money sometimes is misused or goes missing. How common is corruption in government contracting? Why does it happen? What needs to be done to prevent or at least reduce it? A top reporter at the Wall Street Journal addressed these questions this morning at a forum at Sacramento State. Andy Pastor has a long history of covering corruption for the Journal, and in 1995 he wrote the book When the Pentagon Was for Sale. He spoke at the invitation of the university's Center for Practical and Professional Ethics. He's in our studio. Andy Pastor, welcome to Inside.
Nice to be here. I appreciate it.
Well, there are plenty of laws and regulations meant to stop the misuse of money in government contracting. So why does corruption still happen?
Because the money is so huge and the incentive to try to get an edge on your competitors is so strong that it's very difficult to avoid, and particularly in the defense arena where contracts are hundreds of billions of dollars, that's with a B, lasting over many, many years, and the large ones only come up now and then. So there's tremendous incentive to try to get whatever kind of edge you can.
Give us an example of a particularly egregious case of corruption in a government contract.
I think in recent years, you have to say Boeing Company, which is a firm that everybody knows, both commercial and military production. They have been, I would say, the most prominent example of ethical lapses and criminal behavior. They managed to steal thousands of pages of documents from one of their rivals in a rocket competition. They hired the chief acquisition official of the Air Force, the chief civilian acquisition official, and offered her a job while she was still overseeing contracts, which they had. And they ended up paying about $615 million for all of these violations.
That's pretty shocking to hear that such things could go on in a case involving such a famous company and such a big high-profile contract.
That's absolutely right, and it created a huge hubbub on the Hill and, of course, got a lot of publicity. And I think one of the main points to take from it is how difficult it is to punish large defense contractors because the things they make are essential. There are no other alternatives in many cases for the weapons and weapon systems that they make. So therefore, they can be fined, which amounts to a slap on the wrist. They can be embarrassed publicly, but in terms of actual punishment to withdraw contracts, to keep them from getting new contracts, that's almost never done because there's no one else who could supply those kinds of systems.
If someone from Boeing or some other defense contractor is here, what do you think they would say in their defense? I'm sure you've talked to many of these people.
Well, I have, and they'd say what they basically tell the government. First, they'd say that it's only a renegade bunch of few renegades inside the company who are responsible for the irregularities. Then they would say that the material they stole or the inside information they got or the influence peddling wasn't really all that significant. And their final fallback would be, we have changed the way that we operate. We have completely revamped our ethics programs. And so therefore, we may have made some mistakes in the past, but going forward, you can trust us as good corporate citizens.
Mistakes were made, as they say.
I think that is the way that they would react. And to be fair, Boeing and other companies have, of course, made significant changes after the investigations and after the illegalities were discovered.
You said that one excuse that can be given is that this kind of thing is done by renegades. And I guess we'd like to think that's the case. We don't want to think that huge, prestigious companies would actually, coming from the top, make decisions to engage in criminal or at least dubious behavior.
Well, that's right. And in many cases, the government isn't able to absolutely show in a court of law that the top executives actively promoted or encouraged this kind of activity. But I think the implication and the conclusion you can draw is that by setting a tone at the top, by allowing some of these irregularities to occur, by looking the other way, by not paying enough attention to the warning flags internally, senior executives indirectly are responsible for what happens to those companies, and the companies should be held corporately responsible for their behavior.
Do you know of any cases involving well-known companies where at the board level or at the senior executive level, there have been specific decisions made to do things that were criminal or at least borderline?
Well, I think if we stay with Boeing for a second, because it's the most recent case, they ended up hiring a chief acquisition official of the Air Force, and they offered her this job inappropriately. And there's strong evidence to show that they had these discussions about hiring this person with the chairman of the company and his senior staff president, and that they should have been aware that what was being discussed was improper. It turned out to be illegal and certainly unethical.
My goodness. My guest is Andy Pastor. He's a senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. He covers defense-related topics, white-collar crime, aviation safety, and the global satellite industry. He gave a talk today about government corruption at Sacramento State Center for Practical and Professional Ethics. How common do you think corruption is in the realm of big government contracts?
Of course, it's very difficult to prove or to show because you don't know how many cases go undetected. I would like to look back a little bit to the early 1990s when during a flurry of investigations, 8 out of the top 15 defense contractors in the U.S. were prosecuted for criminal felonies, conspiracy fraud, and other charges, and more than 90 companies and individuals pled guilty to felonies. So that gives you some sense, at least at that time, of what the scope of the problem was. And it's very hard to gauge unless it's fully investigated, of course.
What about outside of the defense contracting business? Are you able to tell us anything about the prevalence of corruption there?
Well, I think in the past 4 or 5 years, many, many big companies from Tyco to Enron to many others that we could name, Adelphia Cable Systems, they have been caught in the most egregious type of corruption. And in some cases, in many cases, people have gone to jail. But the cadence of irregularities really hasn't stopped. Just earlier this month, I told the audience at Sacramento State, Merck, a very big and reputable pharmaceutical company, paid hundreds of millions of dollars essentially for offering cut-rate drugs to hospitals to try to increase their market share, but not offering the same kind of reductions in price to the government for these drugs. And they had a very convoluted explanation of how this could have happened. But in effect, they were bilking the government by charging them much higher prices than they were offering their, quote, premier customers.
Yeah. You said earlier that corruption is almost certainly going to happen because of the huge amounts of money involved and because, at least in the case of defense, the products that are being made are so vital to the nation or perceived as being so vital to the nation and are made by so few organizations that, you know, 2 and 2 equals 4. But what about the people who are writing the checks? What about government elected officials and the people who work for them? Don't they have a vested interest in trying to make sure there's no corruption?
Well, absolutely. And one of the problems is that the investigative forces inside the government, the auditors, the investigators, the folks who work for the Pentagon, civilians who are in charge of looking over these contracts, those numbers have been significantly reduced over the past decade and continue to be eroded. So that, in fact, there are fewer capable, experienced people willing and able to look at irregularities and to find irregularities. And Congress is partly responsible, of course, because they set the budgets, they set the tone, and they're aware of these problems. And it's not a legislative solution that we should be looking for. It's an implementation solution. It's an enforcement issue of how aggressively agencies, including the Pentagon, but other agencies, are willing to look at themselves and say, we need to fix this and this and this and this problem.
Do you know of any problems with campaign contributions from defense companies to members of Congress?
Not in terms of violations of the law. Nothing has surfaced to indicate that these companies are somehow funneling larger sums than they should have or packaging sums. But their influence, of course, is huge because they have large political action committees, and they are a very big force in campaign contributions, though I have to say probably not as large as many other industries in terms of the total amount of dollars. And they spread them pretty evenly. They're careful to hedge their bets so that both Republicans and Democrats get their largesse.
What do you think needs to be done at the federal level to prevent or at least reduce corruption in government contracting?
I think as a first step, you need to make sure that you have independent prosecutors in all of the U.S. attorney's offices who are able and have the staff to pursue these criminal cases. And I think that the public needs to understand that the only way that big problems get fixed is if there's enough pressure from the grassroots, so that folks need to understand that if there are big problems in some of these companies, they have to make lawmakers aware that they're not willing to just stand by and have the company slapped on the wrist, but they really want meaningful punishment of individuals, particularly, of course, because that's the strongest way to send a message, but also of companies.
Seems reasonable to me. Why isn't that already the case?
Because many of these irregularities never come to the surface and aren't prosecuted because they are not discovered. So, of course, it's very hard for the public to know about them. One other example, I would say, is that the Justice Department has started prosecuting companies in a very unusual way. If you or I are prosecuted for some felony, we would be charged. If we're convicted, we would go to jail. We would be sentenced to jail. What they're doing with many companies is called deferred prosecution, which essentially means I'll charge you, I'll allege that you did a number of things, but I won't prosecute you. I'll file the charges away in a drawer, essentially. And if in 2 years you don't do anything bad, you don't violate the law, then those charges will disappear. And that may not be the best way to go about rooting out corruption.
As far as I can tell, your main reporting on corruption has been at the federal level, but you do live in California. Do you know of big problems with government contracting corruption in California with the state government?
There have been, of course, reports about that in various press articles, but I'm not personally aware. I haven't done any reporting on the state level to talk to you intelligently about that.
Okay. I noticed in the description by the Center for Practical and Professional Ethics, the description about your talk, they said at the end that the question, is legal always ethical, would be an issue. What does that mean?
That's a very basic question. Just because you're not permitted from doing something by legislation or regulations, does that mean that's ethical behavior? And we can reel off a number of examples, but maybe one perfect example would be some high-level Pentagon official who becomes a board member of a large defense contractor and then gets pulled back as a special consultant to the defense secretary to figure out what kind of weapons the Pentagon needs to buy in the next 5 or 10 years. That's not legal. That's not illegal. It can be cleared by lawyers. It has been done a number of times. But is that really ethical? Isn't there an inherent conflict of someone who serves on the board of a large contractor going back as a special advisor for the Pentagon?
Finally, Andy, you cover a variety of topics for the Wall Street Journal, defense-related topics, corruption, white-collar crime, and so on. And a couple of weeks ago, we talked with a former Journal reporter, Geraldine Brooks, who's now a novelist. And it turns out that the two of you worked together quite some time ago.
We were together during the first Gulf War. We were passing the night, as it were. We traded off our places in Saudi Arabia and Tehran, waiting for the ground war to start during the first Gulf War.
Goodness. And were you there to cover the government contracting aspect of it, or were you putting that aside at that time and covering it as a war?
No, I was really covering the Pentagon at that time. So we had 4 or 5 people who were based in Saudi Arabia to try to cover the buildup to the war and then the actual ground war itself.
I see. Andy Pastor is a senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. He gave a talk today about government contracting corruption at Sacramento State Center for Practical and Professional Ethics. Andy, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, conductor Laura Jackson. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's one of the big challenges in parenting. On the next Insight, we'll talk with a local psychologist about how sign language can help with potty training. Plus, you'll hear Broadway and TV star Kevin Spiritus, who performs in Reno this weekend, and playwright-composer Rindy Eckert on his unique approach to writing musical theatre. Also, a follow-up on Sutter Butte's development. One of the relatively few women conductors in classical music leads the Sacramento Philharmonic this weekend. She's Laura Jackson, guest conducting the orchestra on Sunday. She's in our studio. Laura Jackson, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Why are there still relatively few women conductors in classical music?
Oh, my goodness. You start out with a big question. And it's one that I really don't, I don't have an answer to. It's, I think we come from an age in the, even as recently as the 1950s, where conductors were seen as these tyrannical figures that sort of looked like Einstein, and they were, you know, all sort of godlike figures. And the more society gets away from that image in other realms, it does also in music. And now we're in an age where music is about collaboration and cooperation, and that opens the doorway for women, I think.
When you were young, did you have that image of a conductor in your mind, and how did that affect your ambition whenever it started to become a conductor?
I think I absolutely had that image in my mind of a conductor. I started out as a violinist, and I actually played professionally for years. So I didn't, you know, my dreams were of playing in Carnegie Hall as a violinist, and I didn't even think of being a conductor until I was in college. And I was at Indiana University, and I found that I was sitting in orchestra, and I was so fascinated by the whole organism, by all the different sounds that an orchestra created and the miracle of these pieces, that I was like messing up. I was making mistakes because I wasn't focusing on playing my own part. And then I started to realize just how fascinated I was with orchestral music and wanted to start leading it.
And what was it about leading an orchestra that appealed to you?
Well, I think that it's a couple of things. One is the challenge and responsibility of interpreting a great work of art. And you see this incredible score in front of you with all of these things, and it's only a roadmap. It's not really the work of art itself until it's sound, until it's happening in space and time. So it's the challenge of doing that. Also, it's the interpersonal relationship with an orchestra and with players, and how it's so, the communication is nonverbal and it's so intimate. And the focus of everyone in a room trying to create something beautiful for a moment and then it dissipates is such an incredible experience. I feel very privileged to be part of it.
My guest is Laura Jackson, guest conductor of the Sacramento Philharmonic Orchestra. She leads the orchestra in a concert this Sunday at the Mondavi Center. What's it like when you first walk into a rehearsal room with a new orchestra, an orchestra that's new to you?
There are so many new things to take in. I actually try to go early and at least take in what the hall looks like and maybe clap my hands a few times and hear what the acoustic is like, because that's all new. And where people sit and just how far people are away from each other, there's a lot. And then, you know, you give the downbeat, and some orchestras play a long time after your downbeat and some play right with you. And it's always like a blind date, you know? I mean, it's always.
Are they sizing
experience.
You up? Do you think the musicians are going, I wonder what she's going to be like?
I'm sure, you know, to some extent, just like I'm thinking, well, what are they going to be like?
Yes.
You know, I think there's always, whenever you meet someone new, whenever you make music with somebody new, there's always an anticipation.
I think you said earlier that the relationship between a conductor and an orchestra nowadays is much more collaborative than it was in the past when you had these almost godlike conductors. Is that good for both women and men conductors today, or is there still a strain among the men conductors of that old style conducting?
I think that in this day and age, it's really quite different for men as well as women. Mm-hmm. And I think that orchestras deserve and require respect. And, you know, so I think most conductors really find that the best results happen when you work with them and respect them as fellow artists rather than dictating to them as if they were children, you know.
When you were a violinist and studying to be a violinist, was there anything that you didn't get from conductors typically that you kept in your mind since then and make sure that you give the musicians as the conductor?
Constantly. And, you know, it's one thing to be on that side and sit in orchestras and you're just always thinking, oh, my goodness, it would be so helpful if a conductor would do this or oh, my goodness, you know, I wonder why they don't hear that this is out of tune. And, you know, it's a different perspective when you're inside the orchestra. And it's such a wonderful thing to experience from that side and then also come around to the other side where you're managing a gazillion different things all at once because everybody's playing something different. And now I see that, you know, as when I was sitting in my chair as a violinist, I may have wanted the conductor's attention on my part all the time, you know, whereas now that I'm a conductor, I realize that my attention needs to be in very specific places and it's perhaps not where every single person in the room might want it to be.
I know many people have wondered about this question. What would happen to an orchestra if the conductor was taken away?
Well, it's really an interesting exercise sometimes to step away. And often what happens, it's really depressing. The orchestra sounds better.
You mean you actually do that as an exercise?
Well, I have certainly... I've done it with youth orchestras where if they're not really listening to each other, sometimes they can get so focused on trying to watch a conductor. If they're young students, they don't understand that you also have to listen and that no amount of visual information can really take the place of that. So I'll step away and then all they have are their ears. And then if they can hear across the hall, you know, I mean, it depends on where you're playing, then things just fall right into place. And sometimes when I'm in a new hall, sometimes I will walk away if it's not a place and a piece that has lots of difficult transitions where they definitely need me. I can certainly step away and just hear the balance out in the hall, which can be very different than what it sounds like right on stage.
Give us a quick rundown of what's on the program this Sunday when you guests conduct the Sacramento Philharmonic.
We start with a piece that was originally written by Carl Maria von Weber. It was a piano piece that Hector Berlioz took and orchestrated. And it's a waltz. Basically, the main body is a waltz. It's just it's a story of a gentleman coming. It's a solo cello at the beginning. He comes and invites a woman to dance. And you hear her saying, no, I mustn't. And he insists because she's so beautiful. And then the waltz starts, and you can see that there's quite a lot of chemistry between the two of them. So it's a wonderful, wonderful piece and a wonderful way to start. We're tipping our hat there with that piece to Ron Cunningham, the artistic director of the Sacramento Ballet. This is his 20th year. And so with that invitation to the dance, we are tipping our hat to him.
Very nice. By the way, I should note to our listeners who can't see us right now, you're very expressive with your hands. You seem very conductor-like as you're
speaking.
And
I'm not even Italian.
Now, then after that, there's a world premiere.
Yes. Oh, I can't wait to do this. I really can't wait to do this. This is by Darren Hagen. He was born in Milwaukee. He lives in New York City now. And just a wonderful, kind gentleman. I've never met him, but I have spoken to him on the phone since I've been studying this piece. And this is a particular fun for a conductor and also a real challenge to take a piece that's completely on the page. There's no tradition that nobody's ever played this piece before. And we're going to realize it for the first time. So
it's a double concerto.
It's a double concerto. And it's for cello and violin and orchestra. And we have these incredible soloists, Jamie Laredo and Sharon Robinson, husband and wife team. And this is fun for me because I grew up as a violinist admiring Jamie Laredo and just sort of watching his career. And so now I finally get to work with him. But it's also something of a love story. And the music is beautiful. It's very dramatic, very lyrical and melodic. It'll be a great piece.
My guest is Laura Jackson, guest conductor of the Sacramento Philharmonic. The musicians we were just talking about in the piece, cellist Sharon Robinson and violinist Jamie Laredo, and this new concerto Masquerade, composed by Darren Eric Hagen. Well, Insight contributor Jeff Hudson spoke with Robinson and Laredo last week at Indiana University, and he also called Hagen in New York to talk about the piece. And let's listen to it.
For a soloist, the task of preparing a concerto begins when they receive the score. Jamie Laredo and Sharon Robinson got the score for Masquerade last July. It's a double concerto, meaning that there are two soloists rather than one. They started learning their parts individually in August, figuring out the melodies and the logistical details. Then, last September, Robinson and Laredo took the concerto to the next phase.
And then we get together, the two of us.
And that's when all the fighting begins.
Yeah, oh, I wanted to do this down bow. No, this is one phrase. No, don't you think there should be crescendo here? And, you know, that's my tune. You need to be quiet there. Things like that.
Laredo and Robinson have been married for 30 years, and they play together a lot, so they brought plenty of common experience to the task. After they'd worked on the concerto as a duo for about a month, they took the next step and brought in a pianist playing a reduction of the orchestral score. Then, after several weeks with the keyboard, they took it a little further.
Finally, in December, we played it for the composer.
And that was always, as always, the most helpful thing of all.
Very illuminating.
Because, you know, to be able to really ask the composer, I mean, how many times have we thought, if we could only ask Mozart this, or if we could only ask Beethoven that, you know. And that's what I love about working with a live composer.
With a double concerto, it's critically important for the two soloists to work closely together, really closely.
We need to be a unit singing as one. That's why the fights occur, because we're trying to hash out, you know, our musical ideas and how it is that we want to say it in the same style.
And, you know, you can say that about an old piece, too. I mean, for instance, I have played the Brahms double concerto with many other cellists in my life, and I have sworn I will never, ever do that again, because it's just not the same as when I played with Sharon.
Oh, I give him permission to do it with Yo-Yo, and that has happened, and that's great. It just feels funny because we know we have come to an understanding of that piece that, you know, many people who play it once or twice could never have. We've lived with that piece for 30 years.
With an established concerto like the Brahms, those decades of experience give Laredo and Robinson an intuitive sense of where they want to go. But a brand new concerto is an adventure. Even after practicing the Hagen for 5 months, Robinson and Laredo still aren't entirely sure what it's actually going to sound like.
You know, it's going to be as big a mystery to us as it is going to be to everybody else, because the first time that our first rehearsal with the orchestra is going to be the first time that we will have heard the piece. I mean, we've been playing it with a piano, but it's just not the same. You know, it really is not the same. And so we're as anxious to know as anybody.
It's one of those great mysteries for the premiere. You really never know until you
get
together, and even until you get on stage, you know, at the concert with the audience and everything. That's when you kind of start getting a feeling of what the piece is all about, truthfully, because you need all these elements, you know, the orchestra part, our two parts, a fine conductor. You need an audience that, you know, gives some feedback. It's a grand experiment every time we do one of these new concertos or, you know, a premiere or something. It's very exciting, but it's not a foregone conclusion that we're going to love the piece or that we're going to make it part of our repertoire forever. It's a scary thing.
But Laredo and Robinson can describe their solo parts. They offered these ideas about the opening movement titled Burlesque.
The burlesque is a movement that's, I would call it frenetic, wouldn't you, Jimmy?
Yeah, crazy. I mean, really crazy.
And although it has moments of kind of repose, but most of it is quite, well, fast to the point of being difficult fast. I have a feeling it's going to be difficult for the orchestra, too, although maybe the writing's spread out enough so that it's not quite so difficult for the orchestra. In the middle of this burlesque, there is a largo, which is for just cello and violin alone. It's a little bit of a cadenza. And that one's very short, though. It's only, you know, like 8 bars, and then we're back to the frenetic craziness. The first movement ends with a largo again.
The end is really beautiful.
The end of the first movement, very, very beautiful.
They also mentioned that the Hagen Concerto does not end with a bang.
It's not the kind of ending where people are going to get up and cheer, because it just evaporates.
It fizzles.
Stops. It just fizzles out. It's like, and that's it.
So, you know, we're gonna see how it works.
But I think it could be very effective.
It could be very effective.
Even the composer isn't entirely sure what his new piece will really be like. I began my conversation with Darren Eric Hagen by relating a story about another composer I knew well in the 1980s who was keen to hear the first performance of anything he'd written.
I was a friend for years with Lou Harrison, and he would always be there at a premiere with his score in front of him and listening to it. And he said, well, you know, I mean, I thought I knew what it was going to sound like, and now that I've actually heard it, I go back.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? It attests to the wonderful abstract nature of music itself, because it's a perfect example of, I don't know if, it sounds like Nixon almost, I don't know if what you thought I said is anything like what I think I thought I said, but what you think I thought I said is probably pretty close.
I understand.
Hagen wrote his new concerto with several ideas in mind. He's a graduate of the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. Robinson and Laredo studied there as well, so they share a certain style. And the late opera composer Giancarlo Menotti was on Hagen's mind. Back when Hagen was a student at Curtis, he spent time with Menotti, and there were connections to Laredo as well.
The music I was writing was strangely Menotti-esque anyway. So when it came to writing something for Jamie and Sharon, I thought about Menotti, whose violin concerto I had heard Jamie play at one point. And I thought, well, there is a shared composer. And then while I was writing the piece, he passed away. And there was no longer any question but that I had to, in mid-course, integrate that fact, because I was very moved by his death, and the fact that there is a strong operatic through story for the two protagonist soloists, all of these things link back to Menotti and the fact that I look to him as sort of an operatic mentor.
But Hagen won't be at the Mondavi Center on Sunday. He's staying in New York because his wife is very, very pregnant with their first child, due any day now. So Hagen will miss the first performance of his new concerto.
Yes, unfortunately, it's due to be premiered on the same day my baby is.
Well, I think you've got the best excuse in the world. So.
I know, it's a lot better than the dog ate my homework.
That was composer Darren Hagen speaking with Insight contributor Jeff Hudson. And Hagen's piece, Masquerade, it gets its world premiere this Sunday at the Mondavi Center. It'll be performed by the other two you heard in that piece, cellist Sharon Robinson and violinist Jamie Laredo, their wife and husband. And in our studio, the conductor of all this, Laura Jackson, who's guest conducting the Sacramento Philharmonic this weekend. Laura, we got a real sense of the excitement and even the fun of doing this world premiere and all that.
Yeah, that was just great to hear the three of them talk about it. And so many things I could relate to. It's really true about a world premiere that you never really know what it's going to sound like when you really bring it to life. So there's a sense of adventure. And of course, you know, our jobs in studying the piece, and certainly mine as a conductor, is to imagine it as vividly as possible so I'm not taken totally by surprise. But even for the composer himself, you know, to say, well, I'm never really sure until I hear it. So that was great.
Great. And just for the record, also in the program on Sunday, Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique.
Yes.
Which is definitely not a world premiere.
No, definitely not. A piece written in 1830, but you'd never believe it if you hear it, because it was hugely adventurous for its time. And, in 1830, no one had written stuff for an orchestra that big, with the extremes of tone painting that he did. It's really a very exciting piece.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure meeting you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Laura Jackson, guest conductor of the Sacramento Philharmonic Orchestra. She leads the orchestra in a concert this weekend at the Mondavi Center. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, violinist, singer David LaFlame. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight or send us suggestions. Our email address is insight@capradio.org. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News on All Things Considered, record-breaking numbers of couples are getting married at the Sacramento County Clerk's Office on this Valentine's Day. And many same-sex couples are requesting marriage licenses too, even though same-sex marriage is banned in California. That story later today. Violinist and singer David LaFlame is best known for forming and leading the late 60s San Francisco band It's a Beautiful Day. Their most famous song was White Bird. The musical interests that went into the band's sound included rock, folk, jazz, and classical. It's a Beautiful Day split up in the 70s, but partially reunited in the late 90s as the David LaFlame Band. They play tonight in Sacramento in our studio. David Flame and singer Linda Baker LaFlame, also guitarist Rob Espinosa. Welcome all to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
It's our great pleasure. David, you were born in Connecticut, but you were raised for the most part, I think, in Salt Lake City.
How did
you make it from there to San Francisco? And why?
Courtesy of the United States Army, actually. Yeah. I was stationed at Fort Ord for a short period of time in the early 60s, and I got a couple of weekends leave. This is coming from Salt Lake City now, where I was in the U.S. Army Reserves. And so we did our basic training there at Fort Ord. And so a couple of weekends ago, I met a fellow there at Fort Ord that was in my barracks that was from San Francisco. So he invited me to go up to his parents' house in San Francisco and hang out a couple of different weekends. And I just went crazy. I fell in love with the place. Mm. I mean, it was just – and when I finally got out of the Army – I decided that that's where I would make my new home. I didn't know a soul there other than him. He was a concert pianist, and he was quite mad. He was a wonderful person, but he was quite mad.
Your background was really more in classical music at that time, wasn't it? You played with the Utah Symphony?
I totally classical background. But at the same time, I was a young kid who really loved all kinds of music, and I played a lot of classical music. I listened to more popular music, more jazz and blues, and that kind of music is what I preferred to listen to. That's why I suppose sort of in my early 20s, I sort of abandoned my classical roots and started getting more into playing other styles.
My guest is David LaFlame, violinist, singer, and leader of the David LaFlame Band, which plays tonight at Marilyn's and K in downtown Sacramento. So you arrive in San Francisco when everyone's playing electric guitar, and here's David with his violin.
You know, I went around with my violin like an idiot, and I would go and find where these different bands were playing, and I would bring my violin there, and they would look at me like I was crazy. There was one point, however, when the Grateful Dead was actually very interested, according to Joel Selvin, very interested in me actually being in their band, because they liked me and they liked the way I played and everything. But it was decided amongst them at that period that they were afraid if they included me, it might sound like too country. That was the thing. But I also play guitar, so I used to double on guitar and violin, and so I assured them that, one, I could help them with the songwriting, and two, I could still play guitar, even if they didn't want violin, but they didn't have me. Well, I became so frustrated with all these other groups who wouldn't have me, including the Charlatans and the Quicksilver and a bunch of other groups that were just in infancy at that time, mm-hmm. quite frankly. They were all bands that were just playing cover tunes, dancing in the streets and stuff like that, yeah. You know. Quicksilver was doing like Pride of Man and all that. They ticked me off so much that I decided the only way I'd ever be able to be in a band is to start one myself.
And where did the name It's a Beautiful Day come from?
That came from a young girl who was working as our manager's secretary one day at lunch on the street in San Francisco on Van Ness Avenue. And she started talking about what a beautiful day it was. And our manager at that time suggested that perhaps we would call the band It's a Beautiful Day, which, by the way, I was totally against. I wanted a name that was more like Iron Butterfly or Led Zeppelin, something that had a dichotomy to it that had the two sides. I felt like It's a Beautiful Day sounded too
nice, nice.
Too nice, nice. And, you know. And it, for years, Bill Graham would come out and introduce us as some of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet. And I used to go, "Bah, that's just what I didn't want." You know, I mean, No matter how I tried, I just couldn't get any kind of a bad boy image going.
Well, you should have called yourself La Flame, like Santana called themselves Santana. You know, that works.
That would have worked, yes. But in those days, it was all for one and one for all. And you wanted a group name and a group type of consciousness, you know?
Now, Linda, you met David in 1973 in San Francisco. Now, I read, you wrote, quote, "I hadn't been real fond of It's a Beautiful Day. I knew the song White Bird, but I really didn't like it."
It's true. I was into the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix. And I actually worked in Jimi Hendrix's studio in New York. So I got to see a lot of people coming and going through the recording studio all the time. And they just kept playing White Bird over and over and over in New York, because that's where I was from. I am from. And they played it over and over, and I would just say, that song is just, get rid of it. You know, it's just.
I always tell her, be careful what you hate.
It's not even cool. You know,
ended up singing it the last 30-something years.
Of course, I love it now. I mean,
what was not cool about it in your mind?
Well, to me, it just didn't have. I wasn't used to the violin. I wasn't used to that part at all. Yeah. And I liked, you know, crunchy guitar sound. I liked, you know, heavy, badass vocal. You know, I like that kind of a thing.
That specifically is what made that music so interesting and intriguing, was the fact that now you're combining a violin with the electric sound.
And a lot of people still think that idea sucks, you know what I mean? that the violin has no place in rock and roll. How many times have I heard that? People are very prejudiced about the violin.
Well, we went out on the Summer of Love tour this past summer. We went with the Starship and Quicksilver and Big Brother and us. And it was really, we had a great time. But everybody wanted David to play with them. It was really, it was
amazing. Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
People ask me, I'll tell you a quick little story about the violin that people like yourself might ask me this question. And I've been asked it so many times. Do you ever get tired of playing that White Bird song of yours?
I won't ask it.
And I would pause and I'd say, well, yes, sometimes I do get a little tired of playing it. But then I always say to myself, you should be very thankful. You could have written In a Gotta Davide. We were performing at the Whiskey A Go Go, and it was the 40th anniversary of the Whiskey A Go Go in Los Angeles a few years ago. And I told that joke on stage, and I had no idea. My friends, the Iron Butterfly, were all sitting in the audience that day.
Ex-friends.
And it was so,
they haven't spoken to us since.
I'm not sure if they were all laughing at my sense of humor. I don't think so. That's about the way I feel about it, really. It's been a blessing and a curse, like most wonderful things are.
Well, I think that's a great cue to ask you, the three of you, to play part of White Bird.
Okay.
David has his violin, and Rob Espinoza has brought his guitar. And just to remind you, these are the key members of the David LaFlame Band, which plays tonight at Maryland's on K in downtown Sacramento. Okay, well,
acoustic thing. Now, tonight, of course, will be our seven-piece electric band.
Yes. Indeed.
Yeah. So you have to understand there'll be seven of us there tonight, and we make a lot of sound.
Yes, we do.
I bet.
White Bird is a big bird.
Okay.
We're going to do a little bird now.
Two, three, four.
Alone. across the long black road, up to the darkened sky. In its rays, but the white bird just sleeps in her cage, unknown. White bird must fly, or she will die. White bird must fly, or she will die.
Wonderful. That was a stripped-down version of White Bird, performed by David LaFlame and Linda LaFlame and guitarist Rob Espinosa of the David LaFlame Band tonight at Maryland's on K in downtown Sacramento. David, I've got to ask, watching you sing and play the violin at the same time, is that hard to sing and play the violin?
Actually, it is very difficult. And now, this is bragging a little bit, but as far as I know, I'm the only person that I've ever met. Isn't that right, Linda? Who can play the violin and sing at the same time?
Well, Doug Kirshner could do it.
Yes, but he used to sing and then play and sing and then play. Or play. You, in other words, if you're playing a little country thing, you're just doing, you know, well, anybody can do that. But to play a part that's a different part.
That's very true. You're right.
To play a different part from the one you're singing. In other words, doing two parts at the same time, one on the violin. I don't know anyone else that can do that or ever has.
And your
why
whole...
they wouldn't want to, I don't know. It's just one of those things I started doing long, long time ago, and it just became part of the way I do it, sing and play at the same time.
Because you're holding the violin in place on your chest with your jaw. But, you know, in order to sing, you have to move the same jaw.
Yeah, ventriloquism. Exactly. I use ventriloquism on the vocals. I'm actually throwing my voice. No, I don't know. It's just something I've always done for a long, long time. And, you know, I still do it that way sometimes.
You keep moving your jaw.
Yeah. My head doesn't want to move as much as it used to, I'll tell you that. In fact, I've just had my annual physical. Fortunately, I passed with flying colors this year. But the doctor said to me, I don't know how you can continue on like this, David, playing that violin like that, you know, with your head all to the side and all this.
Sure.
And quite frankly, after a couple of nights of playing, I have to rest for about a week.
He looks like Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein.
That's it, exactly. Yeah. The eyes are bulging and the my muscles are swollen.
Yes. Very good. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we do have to keep enough time to thank you all very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Linda LaFlame, David LaFlame, Rob Espinosa. They and the rest of the David LaFlame Band playing tonight at Maryland's
and
Kate.
Don't be afraid to come by.
Come on by. We're going to have some fun.
It's going to be fun. We can tell that. Well, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Let's put our clothes on and get out of here.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Jason Treadaway. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our interim producer is Robin Souza. We'll go out with White Bird. Thank you for joining us. It's one of the big challenges in parenting. On the next Insight, we talk with a local psychologist about how sign language can help with potty training. Plus, you'll hear Broadway and TV star Kevin Spiritus, who performs in Reno this weekend, and playwright-composer Rindy Eckert on his unique approach to writing musical theater. Also, a follow-up on Sutter Butte's development. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.